Hello, I'm Joe Quirk. Welcome to Seasteading Today. I talk to seasteaders and their supporters, and today we're going to learn about enterprise cities, which are new legal regimes, and how they get started in actual practice. Shankar Singham is one of the most experienced and well-known international trade and competition lawyers in the world, having authored the leading textbook on the subject. And he's also written over 100 articles and book chapters. And now he's managing director for the Competitiveness and Enterprise Development Project at Babson Global, which is the commercial arm of Babson College. So Shankar, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
And you you hosted a speaker series called The Moral Case for Free Markets. And from what I understand in your book, your competition and trade theories concentrate on, you know, the relief of global poverty. And what drives you on this? Why do you care so much?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's very hard not to care when you see the levels of poverty around the world. I mean, I've lived in many, many different countries, and we are in the US, and I grew up in London, so in the UK and Western Europe, we are tremendously privileged. We have no idea generally how privileged we are. I mean, if you look at some, you know, current poverty statistics, the reality of life for most people in the world, for example, there are 2 billion children in the world. Of those 2 billion children, 650 million of them do not have shelter. The most basic need, most basic requirement that most of us take for granted, and fully a third of the children of the planet do not even have shelter. Half the population of the planet lives on less than $2.50 a day. And 80% of the population of the planet lives on less than $10 a day. The numbers on people who have access to sanitation and electricity and all these things are also appalling reading. And I think there has been, if you look throughout history, there has been no more powerful force for lifting people out of poverty than those three things that I talked about before: property rights protection, competition, and open trade. Nothing has lifted people out of poverty at the rate that those things have done. If you look at China, which is very, you know, has not done, you know, the best job imaginable on building competitive markets, but certainly opened up a lot in trade in the last since Deng Xiaoping. You know, China's reduced its poverty level from 85% to 15%. You know, 15% is still way too high, but imagine, you know, that change. That's hundreds of millions of people being lifted into the middle class, which is an extraordinary achievement. It's not as much as they need to do, and they're obviously coming from a very, very low base. But these are the most important issues, in my mind, of our time. And it's simply, I've always had the view that, you know, the lot of someone who lives in, you know, a poor situation in Bangladesh, for example, is just that person is just as much my neighbor as, you know, my neighbor down the street here in the suburbs of Wellesley, Massachusetts. And I think it's simply unconscionable to allow people in the world to live as they do, given the potential that we have to really have a very, very different kind of world, and a world framed by abundance and prosperity and fulfilling jobs and hope, as opposed to one of scarcity, which is unfortunately the reality in the vast majority of cases of people in the world.
Now, Seasteaders are interested in new experiments in governance. And you write the actual legislation for that creates these legal startups. So what are enterprise cities, and how are they different from special economic zones?
Right. Well, just to clarify, they're not entirely legal startups, because what we do is, with the enterprise city, what happens is a host government, the government of a country, and our projects are primarily in developing countries and emerging markets because they are primarily poverty alleviation projects. So the Enterprise City sort of exists when a host government agrees with a developer or by itself agrees to create a zone that has some degree of regulatory autonomy from the country and agrees a regulatory framework, again, either with a developer or, you know, separately by itself, a regulatory framework. So far, that's exactly like a special economic zone or a special administrative region. The difference, I think, is that in the enterprise city, the regulatory framework itself that underpins the normative framework in the zone is governed by three primary principles, which are property rights protection, competitive markets, competition on the merits as an organizing economic principle, and an open trading environment. And so, unlike a special economic zone, which is very much based on fiscal incentives, tax breaks, and so forth, and attracts foreign investment simply because of the tax breaks it offers, what the Enterprise City does is it attracts both foreign investment and domestic investment into the zone because of the competition on the merits nature of the framework. In representing global capital over many years, over 25 years, what I constantly hear from people is we don't actually want all these tax breaks and tax incentives. What we really want is a level playing field for competition. And if we get that, then we'll invest. So the Enterprise City is essentially offering that as the investor proposition.
So the key is regulatory autonomy.
There has to be some degree of regulatory autonomy because naturally you're working in countries, developing and emerging markets, where the regulatory system, and by regulatory system I mean more than just regulations, I mean the legal system, the economic system, the governance system, is highly skewed in favor of incumbent companies, in favor of the vested interest elites, the oligarchs, et cetera, and really are sort of crony capitalism. So what we're trying to do and where you need some degree of regulatory autonomy is to create an environment where instead of favoring oligarchs, vested interests and elites, the regulatory system, the legal system, the economic system favors new companies, people with good ideas, people who are prepared to work hard. And that's ultimately the test of whether they're competitive or not.
I want to ask you a little about your background. It sounds like you spent your early career working on the privatization of laws for competition in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and then later in Latin America. And it sounds like you were really on the front lines of creating legal structures when these highly controlled economies opened up their markets, you know, to engage with the world. And how did this shape your view, and what did you learn from that experience?
Well, that's a very good question. My career essentially started with the privatization of the UK electricity industry, where we were counsel to the National Grid Company, which was the transmitter and distributor of electricity in the UK. We then did a lot of work in, as you said, the former Soviet Union and Central Eastern Europe. We did a lot of the privatization laws in those countries. We wrote competition laws in Hungary and Poland and Estonia, and did the accessions for Hungary and Poland into the European Union. In the early 90s, I then went to Latin America and did much the same thing there after the Apertura. And I think in the last 20 years, or 25 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the chief lesson that I learned from this whole experience is that we had all made an assumption when we engaged in these processes that merely opening up the border and opening up trade would lead automatically to competitive markets inside the border. And that assumption proved not to hold true. And so it was the lack of competition inside the border that led to the development of the oligarchs in the former Soviet Union, that led to the entrenchment of rent-seeking elites in Latin America. And so we spent a lot of time in the 90s and 2000s working with domestic competition agencies to try to correct for this flaw, because the lack of competition and the lack of efficiency in these markets was costing huge amounts of value, huge amounts of money being destroyed every year as a result of distortions of these markets. And so what I realized from doing this is that actually, counterintuitively, the ability to do the sort of next generation of reforms, if you will, in countries around the world, having opened up, having joined the WTO, having, you know, to some extent opened up their markets, the next stage of reform, which was really the behind the border barriers, the distortions inside the markets, that was actually much harder to accomplish now than it was even 20 years ago, because the elites had become so powerful. So and this is really how I came to the idea of the enterprise city. It was really by the exclusion of all other possibilities, that whatever you have left, you know, Sherlock Holmes has this famous statement that, you know, once you've eliminated everything that is impossible, whatever you have left, however improbable, must be the truth. So having eliminated the ability to do reform at a national level because of these political issues, I fell into the idea that actually, given the fact that you also have tremendous urbanization, given the fact you have billions of people moving from the country to the city, given the fact you're getting these greenfield sites that are created by countries, you know, all over the place, 100 cities in India, 500 in China, that maybe you could actually get the kind of reform that countries want to do. They actually want to do this. It's not a technical problem. It's a political problem. They want to do this. Maybe you could get it inside that zone, and then it could become a demonstration model for the rest of the country and actually demonstrate non-zero-sum economic growth, which is really what an enterprise city ought to be able to do if it has the right regulatory environment.
I heard you say an astonishing thing, which is that regulatory distortions account for $1.5 to $2 trillion of the U.S. economy alone, which is like 12 to 15% of the economy. And the U.S. is a relatively free economy with some room to maneuver, but I think about Russia and China and India and Latin America. I mean, is it fair to say that if humanity was unleashed from these regulations, we'd live in a world incalculably more wealthy and happy than we have now?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there is a we're always prisoners of the time in which we live, and if we don't have a good grasp of history, then we can't always see the context in which.
So I want to ask you about Cardwell's law, which is something I read about. It's apparently an empirical regularity that has apparently been observed throughout history, which is that, you know, even if regulatory bodies start out serving a positive purpose, they embody a system of incentives that drives the rules and regulations to increase inexorably until they end up quashing the innovation and stifling competition. It's like there's a Laffer curve where past a certain point, more rules lead to less progress. And so what good would new enterprise cities do to counteract this phenomenon?
You know, I think there is a big debate about, you know, more regulation, less regulation. And I think it's in many ways a false debate, because the issue is this. The issue is, and again, when I talk about regulation, I'm not talking about sort of as US people would see very specifically regulations, but I'm talking about the entire legal, economic, and governance framework. The question is that, taken in its totality, delivering open trade, competitive markets, property rights protection? In other words, is that delivering economic freedom? And in order to deliver economic freedom, you do need laws and regulations and governments. You need laws and regulations and governments that protect property rights, that protect security, that guarantee economic freedom. So the issue is, do you have a framework that drives competition on the merits, where competition on the merits is the organizing principle? So just to look at the U.S. regulatory system and the explosion of regulation in the U.S. recently, one of the problems is there's been no break. There is no attempt when regulatory bodies and regulatory entities regulate, there is no attempt to consider the cost to the competitive process, to the cost to the market. In the US, we have a very sort of primitive tool, which is a sort of cost-benefit analysis that looks only at compliance cost, you know, business compliance cost, which is not the right mechanism to look at. I mean, what you need to do is look at if we do this regulatory change, what is the cost to the ordinary competition in the market? In other words, how much wealth are we going to be destroying from the economy if we do this? And then legislators can make a decision, not regulators, legislators, speaking, carrying forward the will of the people, can make decisions about whether the regulatory goal is justified, whether it justifies this this destruction of wealth out of the economy. And that's a decision that, you know, is not up to us to make. That's a decision for people to make. But people can only make that decision if they have accurate raw material, if they have accurate inputs going in, which is, here's the regulatory goal, here's what the regulation is intended to accomplish, and here is the cost from a competition standpoint. Is it worth that cost? And the answer to that question may be yes, maybe no, and it's up to people to decide that process. So what we're looking at in the Enterprise City is a regulatory framework that essentially enforces that process to occur. And we believe that if that process occurs, then regulation and legislation and all of these things that define the rules that human beings will sort of live under will be much, much more effective in securing the goal, which ought to be everyone's goal, which is maximizing welfare gains across the whole economic system.
And why would a country agree to host an enterprise city?
For the next 2 minutes, Shankar's voice becomes slightly garbled. You can always hear what he's saying, and I want to encourage you to listen closely, because what he's saying is vital to his vision.
Well, the countries that want to do this, we've discussed now with a number of governments, but we're finding is great take-up of this idea, because countries generally know what they want, what they need to do in order to reform their economies. They understand what the problems are. You know, the WTO, the World Bank, the IMF, countless organizations have sort of explained in various ways what the issues are. They know themselves what the issues are, because their own business people, their own consumers, their own people are telling them, you know, we don't have access to capital. We can't, the cost of energy is high. All of these things. They know what they need to do in terms of reform. The difficulty is that governments very often, in trying to do those reforms, run up against precisely the beneficiaries of the distortion, who are very politically powerful and block reform. And so what the governments that want to do enterprise are telling us is, we think that this way for us to enact a reform that we want to enact nationwide, but we know that as a political matter, we cannot enact it nationwide. So we think that perhaps with France, we can at least agree some of it in this zone. And then let's see, maybe that way we can demonstrate to our people why this regulatory environment can be so powerful, why it can unleash so much wealth, and why we should embrace it at a national level. Because our goal in Enterprise City is not to create, you know, little engines of prosperity, you know, little flowers in the desert. You know, our goal is to have that spread around the country as a whole, so that the whole country can benefit. But we think that's only going to be possible through these demonstration models.
Yeah, you and I, we both cite Hong Kong as a precedent for these new experiments in governance that just create rapid growth and then China imitates it and allows more more such experiments to spread. But what's happening lately is the reason I fantasize about Hong Kong detaching and floating away, because, you know, it's only been two generations and Beijing is flexing its muscle and saying, don't forget, you prosper at our discretion.
Right.
And, you know, what if you set up these enterprise cities, they're successful, and a few generations from now, the embarrassed nation says, well, you know, we're changing the rules, we own this city now.
Right, right. This is the $65 million question, which is the investor. And by investor, I mean anyone who is there. So investor, consumer, resident, person, anyone who is living there. What they need to know, and this is very true in just after the handover of Hong Kong to China, they need to know that the regulatory system is set, that the host government will not change it in the future. Well, they need to at least believe that the likelihood of that happening is low. Now, how did this occur in Hong Kong, which, as you say, is a good example? Well, in the run-up to 1997, there was great fear in the investor community that China would, in fact, change everything in Hong Kong. So the Chinese knew that they had to do something. So what they did is they agreed the basic law of Hong Kong. And the basic law of Hong Kong is a very interesting document because it is itself a regulatory framework agreement. But it was put together by the Chinese government. And the Chinese government essentially guaranteed in the basic law the free trade, free market system of Hong Kong, which is an extraordinary thing to be reading in a document prepared in the 1990s by the then communist Chinese government. But they did it very specifically because they knew that how valuable Hong Kong had been to them and how valuable it could be to them in the future. And they knew that they did not want to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. Now, there is always a tension in a government like the Chinese government between those who recognize that fact and those who don't recognize that fact. And I think you're seeing now, you know, some of that tension being played out. But what protects Hong Kong is not the identity of the Chinese government or who is winning that battle between the reformers and the more conservative elements of the Chinese government. What protects Hong Kong is the basic law. If you remove the basic law, Hong Kong has no protection. Hong Kong is a very good example that of the regulatory framework itself, a government of laws, not a government of men, can actually be believed by the investment community. Because post-97, the land value in Hong Kong went down. People did not believe that China would not interfere. And after a few years, the land value took off because investors started to believe that actually the basic law did govern the relationship between China and Hong Kong. So I think it is possible for the regulatory framework to do that. It has to be written in the right way. It has to carry these three core principles of property rights, competitive markets, and open trade in its DNA. And it has to provide the kind of dispute resolution whereby all parties will think twice about interfering with the economic system that they have all agreed is best for that zone.
And you cite third parties as dispute resolution organizations. What kind of third parties would those be?
Well, I think there's all kinds of dispute settlement bodies that one could think of. You know, just generally over the last 40 or 50 years, the growth and development of arbitration has been very, very successful in convincing investors that, you know, they're not going to be hometowned in local courts, and that they can actually trust the contracts that they have, that they will be properly enforced. So arbitration is their mechanism. There are many other mechanisms of dispute settlement in free trade agreements around the world, which involve other bodies. For example, investor-state dispute resolution in the bilateral investment treaties of countries, which is resolved in the World Bank, in arbitration in the World Bank. So I'm not sure it's necessary to say, or I don't think you need to come up with one particular best form of doing this. I think what you need to do, though, is have recourse to a international mechanism of some kind. State dispute resolution is very powerful. It's a very powerful tool because it shows that the government doesn't have to take the case of an investor who's had his assets taken away or has been abused in some other fashion. But the investor himself can take action. And, you know, nobody wants to be in arbitration. Nobody wants to be in litigation. I used to do a lot of work in the WTO, and I would tell my clients that, you know, if you're in a WTO panel, you know, settlement proceeding, then you have failed. But you don't want that. What you want is that the parties who are involved in the organization and governance of the entity, be that the government, be that a developer, be that whoever it is, know that if they're about to do something bad, if they're about to do something that will destroy welfare of the economy, damage the fabric of the enterprise, that there's significant legal liability at that, so that they can make the appropriate trade-offs. We believe that as long as economic incentives are aligned, that reasonable people will not do things that damage and destroy value. But there has to be a alignment of economic incentives, and there has to be a regulatory framework that allows that to take place.
Yeah, and in your paper, you lay out like four requirements to get these enterprise cities established, and I want to ask you about each, if I may. Mm-hmm. And the first one is you need a committed developer. And I'm curious about this, because why would a developer be more attracted to an enterprise city than some other city?
Well, from a developer standpoint, I think what you're looking at, developers, you know, whether they're master planners or developers, they're looking to create something that is successful. They're looking to create an economically, you know, successful thing. Well, they're obviously not looking to create, you know, the next generation of slums. And so the developer needs to understand that in order to create a successful entity, there needs to be this change or this focus on the regulatory environment. That, in other words, that if you don't do anything, if you don't make any changes to the regulatory framework and you're working in a developing emerging market that has lots of distortions, then you are more likely to create, as a development, something that ends up being, you know, a very dysfunctional, you know, slum-like place. It's not going to be successful.
Yeah. Another requirement you list is the external infrastructure connecting the enterprise city to the host country. I think this is your specialty, and can you walk us through the legal framework for how these two systems would interact?
Yeah, I think, I mean, generally, I mean, it's very hard to have a successful city in the middle of nowhere with no external infrastructure connecting it to the country. So you do look for external infrastructure, and you have to provide that in interacting with that external infrastructure, that the principles of competition prevail. In other words, you do not want a situation where, for example, in telecom, where the interconnection fee that is charged by the external telecom provider is massively anti-competitive and very high cost, because that will increase the costs of all the participants inside the enterprise city. And the name of the game here is keeping costs down. So you want pro-competitive connection of all the different aspects of the infrastructure into the external system. That's why, and that's built into the regulatory framework. So the regulatory framework not only sets out the rules for what's going to happen inside the city, but also the terms on which this interconnection to external infrastructure occurs with respect to the host government.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, another requirement you list, which interests me, assuming I'm interpreting it properly, which is that basically, as I read it, the host nation needs to have the humility to admit it needs improvement. And the best way to discover a solution is to try an enterprise city with a different legal framework. What are the chances that more wealthy countries will be open to enterprise cities?
Yeah, I think generally the countries that are most likely to do this are the ones that know what they have to do in terms of domestic national reform, have tried to do some of it, and have run up against the obstacles that I talked about earlier in terms of vested interest elites and beneficiaries of distortion. So in other words, they know what they have to do to generate jobs and economic development. They've tried to do it and they've failed at a national level. And they are therefore looking at the enterprise city as the potential for, you know, what you might call an alternative delivery mechanism for reform. So if those countries recognize it, I think those are the countries that are most likely to do it. It would be very hard to do this in a very advanced developed market, partly because the attraction of investment, that the big gains are going to come from the delta, the difference between the regulatory environment inside the city and the regulatory environment in the rest of the country and the region. That's what's going to attract capital. This is why Hong Kong was very successful, why Singapore was very successful, why Dubai was very successful, because in the case of Dubai, certainly, they had a different kind of regulatory environment, a better regulatory environment, in the middle of a region that had an incredibly dysfunctional regulatory environment. Mm-hmm. And so in the natural place to be.
And this gets to my personal interest in new regulatory regimes for the 21st century medicine. I live in a rich country, and the industry is distorted with regard to competition in healthcare and medical research, in my view. And you lay out, you know, three key problems for some, like one of them is any government regulation that limits the number of competitors. Another is any government regulation that restricts the ability of newcomers to compete. Another is state-owned enterprises. I don't live in a poor country, but that reminded me of health care and medical research. I wonder if it's possible, you know, seasteaders imagine creating floating medical research ships. I wonder if legal frameworks could be created for such things, or if it's too ambitious a dream.
Well, you know, I mean, you're right to point out, and many people have written about the anti-competitive nature of the U.S. healthcare system. That's not a new thing. All of these applications, medical applications we talked about, other parts of the applications, rest on this same regulatory framework that has to maximize competition, has to ensure that there aren't artificial restrictions on new entrants, on new companies, on foreign investment, on foreign trade, and so forth, which only exists to protect a very powerful vested interest group locally and damage not only those foreign investors, those other entities, but primarily damage the very people in the country who could benefit so much from these new technologies.
Well, this has been a real learning experience for me on multiple levels. And it seems like you've really integrated the heart and the head in this effort. And I hope you can write the legislation for as many enterprise cities in as many countries as possible to welcome these people if they want to migrate there. And I hope someday you can help us create the legislation for coastal seasteads before we can move people to the high seas. And I'm really... I'm really grateful for your time. I know it's very valuable, and this has been very enlightening. So thank you, Shankar Singham. Look him up on Google, and I've learned a lot from watching your videos and reading your stuff, and I'm grateful for the work you do.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks very much. I've enjoyed this, and happy to do it again whenever you need.
Okay, great. I'm going to go listen to this again so I can internalize it all. Thank you, Shankar.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.